Amen. And thank you for that beautiful choral piece from the singing seminarians, or the seminary singers, whatever it is. We love them. I'm going to tell a story to open that if you didn't know it was true, you wouldn't believe it, but it's true because it happened to me. The year was 1984. And my wife and I, Julie, where's Julie? There she is. We were in our first appointment in the North Georgia Conference of the United Methodist Church. And like many denominations, they require CEUs, Continuing Education Units, in order to maintain your ordination. So we were required to attend these training sessions. And so this particular time, it came up. And in the North Georgia Conference, I don't know if it's still that way today, but they had more or less sponsored, they had, of course, a number of sponsored events. There were certain ones they sponsored, and this was like the one that was like everyone would go to. And so there was like an assumption that we would all attend this particular CEU training. And so I was at a district meeting, and they passed out, my DS passed out the brochure, and I got the brochure in my hand. And this was the brochure. The front cover in rather bold letters said, "Lord, teach us to pray." And I thought, oh, this is wonderful. You know, right out of Luke 11:1 that introduces the Lord's Prayer and all this. And then I realized, I looked at the front cover and realized, oh my goodness, there's a misprint. The brochure did not say, "Lord, teach us to pray." It said, "Lord, teach us to play." So I thought, it was a misprint, you know, and so I opened the brochure up and I realized it was not a misprint, because they had inside the brochure, you know, the structure of the next several, the days of the event, and I realized that, in fact, it was a whole retreat or a whole series of training on play. Okay. I'm sure some of us need that admonition. But even in 84, we already were awash with the entertainment culture and the boundary culture and all the things that are just so much a part of our culture today. And so the minute I saw that, and now I'm 25 years old, but I was like, I am not going to go to a conference on Lord Teach Us to Play. I'm just not going to do it. So even as a young minister, I went, you know, somewhat tentatively up to my DS, who, you know, from our point of view as a young minister, you know, he represents God in the flesh. I see Tom back there laughing, the former DS. And I said to the DS, I said, Reverend Kerr, I really would like to attend a different CEU. Is that possible? And he said to me, we want you to be part of the whole group, da, 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 da. But eventually he said, if you can find another one that's been officially sponsored by the United Methodist Church, then you can go. Now, the problem I had was that I only had those, it was like a 4 or 5 day thing going to the weekend. I'd set aside the time, I had a Sunday off, someone already coming in. I had to find an approved UMC, approved CU unit for that very weekend. And that, or that very week in the conference on that particular time. Well, this is the day before the web. There was no computers, so you had to call around. And someone said, well, there is an approved CEU available in Atlanta, Georgia on that very week. So I called the church and I said to them, is this true? Yes, it's true. There's a young man from Texas coming. It's approved. It was Terry Tickle. And he's going to come and speak to us, and it's part of a CEU unit. And so I said, what is the name, you know, what is the title of the conference? And they said to me, the title of the conference is Lord, Teach Us to Pray. That's a true story. So I had been assigned the conference training, Lord, Teach Us to Play. And the providence of God, I ended up at a conference, Lord, Teach Us to Pray. And even though those two letters, L to R, are so insignificant, it was in fact one of the great turning points, fork roads in my life. I was headed for a life of play. I probably wasn't that good at it. I was headed to a life of play, but something happened that day, and I was turned, and I went to that conference, and my wife and I discussed this many times, but if not for that conference, I would have never had a 35-year ministry in North India, working in North India, because of a four-day conference that I wasn't supposed to be at. If not for that day, I would not have had 11-year teaching ministry at Gordon Conwell. And if not for that day, I would not have had 11 years and counting ministry here at Asbury Seminary. And I do not believe it was anything less than the providence of God that he redirected me, and it was on the same theme with one letter difference. Now, those of you who are church historians will remember that the whole church's Christology came down to one letter. Do you know what I'm talking about? Come on now, help me here. Homoousion, homoousion. Am I talking language here, you understand? If you know what I'm talking about, raise your hand. Okay, there's four of you. No. The church fought over those two words. One letter difference. An omicron to an iota. Homoousion of same substance. Homoousion of like substance. And it came down to, was our Christology going to be Arian or going to be what we now know as Orthodoxy? All because of one letter. Homoousion, homoousion. A lot of life comes down to that, where when you least expect it, a little fork in the road will happen, and usually something that God happens, pushing your life, and you realize looking back on it, your whole life has changed. And in that little conference, I have this overhead. Do we have an overhead projector of a picture of a little book that I was introduced by Terry Tackle called The Hour That Changed the World by Dick Eastman. It's gone through. It's in its 25th anniversary edition or whatever, or maybe more than that, 25th edition. Anyway, over however many gajillion copies printed, but it's a remarkable book. We come this morning to part five in this series, on the means of grace, and three of the 12 parts of this series are dedicated to prayer. This is the first of them. There'll be another one December 3rd, another March 10th, but this particular one is about personal persistence in prayer. And this particular story is told, Jesus opened by saying, he told the disciples a parable to show they should always pray and not give up. Now that is a great admonition, to always pray and not give up. My life prior to that wonderful 4 days, 5 days with Terry Tackle was about basically sporadic prayer and giving up a lot. And something happened, and this parable captures it, because this parable, Jesus introduces for us two characters in the story, right? You have the unjust judge, who are told neither fears God nor man, and you have the widow. Now, the judge who's portrayed here is a man who's clearly an unbeliever. He does not know God. He does not care about the things of God, even has no heart for justice, even on a humanistic level. He was most likely appointed for political reasons or whatever, not because of his integrity or the wisdom of his insights. He wasn't there by popular vote. He, we're told, summarize his character, he feared neither God nor money. He was probably not only unconcerned about justice, but would only render it if someone bribed him. That's the character of this judge. How would you feel if your only hope was to bring your case before such a person? How would you feel if this was your only recourse with no right of appeal? This is a situation that this is our widow is in, which is the second character. And this widow is the picture of helplessness and vulnerability. She has no rights in the ancient world. There is no redundancies in the system. You can't appeal. There's no right of appeal. There's no protections. We don't know, Jesus doesn't give us the details, but these type situations were plentiful in the ancient world, and oftentimes it came to a couple of matters that are most frequent. Number one, her husband had land, he passed away, and someone simply occupied the land, like Ahab did to Naboth's vineyard in 1 Kings 21. Or someone owed her husband money that rightfully belonged to them, and he died, and the debt just disappears. Things like that happened. We don't know the exact situation, but we know she is desperate. And even though she had no legal standing, no proper cultural status, she wasn't a shaker and mover, was not somebody people noticed or listened to, she did have one great quality. And it is this quality which is highlighted in the text. Her quality that God had given to her was persistence. She would not let him go. She kept coming back to him. Give me justice for my adversary. Give me justice. Give me justice. Give me justice. She would not let it die. And even though he cared nothing about God nor man, cared nothing about her, cared nothing about anything in her situation, he got sick of being bothered. And eventually he said, I'm going to give her what she wants just to get her off my back. I mean, literally, the phrase here in the original language essentially is, she's going to knock him out with a punch. Martin Luther translated, I'm going to give her heaven because she will deafen me, because she will not let it go. And so he says, verse 5, I'm going to see to it that she gets justice so she won't wear me out with her coming. Now that's persistence. Now, Jesus, of course, tells the parable to make a point about prayer. Now, when you read the story, of course, this is one of those great moments we learn about Jesus as a teacher, because he teaches a lot through comparison, but sometimes, like here, through contrast. The unjust judge is meant to be a contrast with God. Okay, clearly, God and the judge are in the same position in terms of being the one who can act in a situation. But in this case, it's meant to show us, this is the kind of, I think the late phrase for this is the how much more so principle. You know, if the unjust judge grants her petition, how much more so will God? This judge was unjust. The Lord is just. The judge has no concern for justice. The Lord is the very embodiment of justice. The judge didn't want to listen to the woman's case. He'd rather never laid eyes on her. But God says, call unto me and I will answer you and tell you great and mighty things you do not know. The judge was aloof and unconcerned about her plight. Jesus says, come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden, I will give you rest. The judge has no desire to support this widow, but the word of God says, the eyes of the Lord move to and fro throughout the earth, that the Lord may strongly support those whose heart is completely his. It's meant to be a dramatic contrast. So not only is the unjust judge being contrasted, but also, of course, the widow is also being contrasted. Because sometimes you hear the point made, well, the widow is like the church. Well, the widow is like the church in the sense that we are pressing in, we are being persistent, but the widow is also unlike the church. The widow has no legal standing before the judge. The church has, we are justified before God, right? The widow has no rights. We are the redeemed, adopted, blood-purchased children of God. The widow has no confidence in this process. Hebrews 4:16 says, draw near to the throne of grace with confidence. The widow is vulnerable. We dwell in the shadow of his wings. And this whole parable is about pressing in and not giving up. Now, there's a couple of insights, I think, that have been brought to me over the years from this passage and in general text about prayer. And the first actually comes from this little book by Dick Eastman I showed you earlier, The Hour That Changes the World. He makes the very simple point that I want to press upon you today, that prayer is the ultimate expression of our trust in God. We're going to give you an opportunity to come forward and to pray at the end of our service today. We'll have several people here to pray with you. But it's a way of saying there's something in your life that you need to put into God's hands and learn to trust Him with this. This is interesting because persistent prayer is another way of saying unanswered prayer, isn't it? The very fact that it requires persistence means it remains unanswered. And we have to press on. The unjust judge did not grant her request immediately. It required persistence. In that sense, there's a similarity here that we are asked to persist in our prayers. We have a journal. My wife and I have a journal in our home called, I should say our home, your home that we live in. We have a little journal called Windows into Heaven, which is a book of answered prayer and times where God intervened in our lives. But even that book is preceded by a lot of unanswered prayer, getting to that point that, you know, only certain things qualify to make the book, you know. But we also have many, many unanswered prayers in our lives. I live in a state of unanswered prayers. There's so many things that we are agonizing for, praying for, that remain unanswered. But yet it's caused me to press in with persistence. That's the way it works. That is part of how God is changing me and changing us. My whole professional life, I was spent training missionaries. That's what I did, both in India as well as in the U.S. And my whole life was about, you know, mapping out the lost world and, you know, the needs of the world. That was my whole life. I'd give my life to that enterprise. If you'd asked me 15 years ago, you know, is there anybody that cares more about the lost world? I mean, I've got to be up there in the top 10%. You know, that's my life, is burden for the lost. And then, at some point, it came to us in our personal family life. Our oldest son has walked away from the Lord. It was very, very hard for us. We have a daughter in the mission field. We have a son who's not walking with the Lord. And it's unresolved, by the way. It's unresolved. And we have a regimen of prayer for him. But what really amazed me about the now 10 years, a decade of prayers for that situation, that's just one example, but it's our deepest one, is that I realized how little I had actually cared about the lost. Because before, overstating, but it was almost like statistical analysis for me, you know. This percentage of people haven't heard the gospel. We have to strategize better, do better, plan better, da 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 da. But something was happening. I realized that this is my son. You know, these are people that I know and love. And I would say over the last 10 years especially, we have come to know so many families like ours, somewhere in our own community, with children or grandchildren that are lost, or brothers and sisters of those in this room, and that are part of our prayer time as well. In fact, Tuesday, today is the day that my wife and I dedicate particularly to those prayers. But the whole point is something happened in me and us through this process of persistence. God's just not like, you know, I want to be a tough guy, but the Lord is bringing me into this agony because it's His agony for the world. Persistence and unanswered prayer are the two sides of the same coin of trust. And God is not Santa Claus, where you climb up in His lap, tell Him what you need, and the answer appears under the tree before the month is out. And it's a grown-up Christian who realizes that. And we have a lot of theology in the world in general. It's in the U.S. too, but all over the world, there's a huge tsunami of theology that says that God is like that, and He's not. And this parable teaches us that. The second insight for me in this, actually, I think is best summarized by Stan Key at the Francis Asbury Society, where he makes the point where he says, prayer is God giving us the dignity of causality. Now this to me, I think particularly the Wesleyans have captured this, I think in a great way. I think the whole church kind of wants to believe it, but we believe it, in the sense that God, of course God is sovereign. Of course God can change every heart. God can solve every political crisis. God can right every wrong. God can balance every injustice. There's no question God has the power to affect any change he wants in the world, in our lives, and the lives of others. But in his sovereignty, he also wants to bring us into the causality of the whole thing. It's a mystery, isn't it? Part of the mystery is that we are brought into this and we become part of God doing things. And it is a liminal space that we dwell in that is extremely challenging. And we celebrate it more than we should, in the sense it celebrates agony, because it's in that liminal space of what is and what could be or might be or what will be. And we live in that space. And we actually begin to take on the burdens of people who are also in agony. And this is where the means of grace comes in, because it's not simply that as we pray for a lost world or lost people or lost situations or things that are not set right, that need to be set right, and someday will be set right. That if it was simply God creating empathy in us, then we would be empathetic people, and it's never less than that, but it's more than that, because the means of grace, we're actually giving the dignity of bearing the suffering and pain of lostness. When I'm praying for a lost person, this is them praying through us. Now that is a real eye-opener for me. When I'm going to realize that when you bring your burden to me, and you, or maybe you come forward and someone, a faculty member, prays with you today, it's not simply you sharing your burden, but they take on this burden. They help you bear. Christ says, bear one of those burdens and fulfill the law of Christ. It's actually part of what it means to bear the burdens and do this. This is what finally Steve Siemens calls sacrificial intercession. It's not simply that we sacrifice our time or that we need to pray more or fast more. I'm sure it's true, but it's not simply that. It's that the time that we devote to prayer, we enter into this space of deep, deep sacrificial engagement. We come into Christ's own sacrifice. We come into Christ's burden for the world. We come into Christ longing for us to be a part of that in the world. This is Oswald Chambers says, the way we participate in the sufferings of Christ is in intercession for others. And our daughter is in this sacrificial intercession for the Alagua. She's also lived for 10 years. With an unreached group with no Christians in the middle of Tanzania. And she's lived there long enough to enter into the whole burden of their lostness, the burden of their brokenness. She bears their brokenness. It's not about time. It's about your whole way of life, how we enter into this, how we bear it. These are things that are hard to fully explain. I feel like in ways I'm talking to somebody where someone says, who's never played football, and someone gets up and gives you a lecture on football. You don't need a lecture on football. You just need to play football. Just play football. Just enter into the engagement of it. Alfred Lord Tennyson said, more things are wrought by prayer this world ever dreamed of. And the whole parable ends, as very few parables do actually, with a question mark. It's amazing he ends with a question. How much more so will this judge, give her what she needs? And will not God bring about justice for his chosen ones? There's the contrast with the widow. We are his chosen ones who cry out to him day and night. That persistence. I want to be in that train where God knows I'm crying out to him day and night. Will he keep putting them off? I tell you, he will see they get justice and quickly. However, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth? That's the close of the parable. When he comes, will he find us a part of this enterprise. He has provided an open door for us. You know, you knock and you knock and you keep on knocking, but you're knocking at the right door. And that open door to us is to be a part of and participate in the redemption of the world. And it's also about God sanctifying us and making us into his own image. It's a mystery. It's a mystery. It is less and less about getting things we want and more about aligning ourselves with what God is doing, his purposes in the world. And you know, in that amazing book, Pilgrim's Progress, which we recently reread, I know all of you probably read it, but one of the most remarkable books, but why do some people go in and the narrow gate's right there, they go straight to it, and others have to go around the whole thing and then finally end up at the narrow gate? Why? And there was no answer for it. He says, God knows the shortest person, the shortest distance each person needs to the gate. God knows the distance between the needs of this world and his ultimate inbreak of the new creation. And he knows that, and he's affecting that in the world, and he calls us to be a part of that in the world. So may God invite us afresh into this great mystery of the church, to join him in establishing his purposes, changing the world, and giving glory to himself. Amen.